What happens when physics, physiology, and music collide? Oh, opera turns the human body into an extraordinary acoustic instrument. And there's a surprising amount of science behind the sound.
We're joined in the studio today with Park City Opera co-founders Benjamin Beckman and Lena Goldstein, who will help us together understand the science behind the operatic voice. They'll explain both the physics of sound, vibration, frequency, harmonics, acoustics, and why a singer's voice can fill a concert hall without amplification.
And they'll explain the biology of singing, from the vocal folds and breath to the resonating spaces in the head and chest that help transform air into a powerful, expressive sound. Lena, Ben, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, that's really cool. So first of all, I'm just going to say that we all met through the Opera Around the World program that you have, and I've been attending just about every single one of them in the Park City Park here in Park City, Utah, and it's been an absolutely wonderful program. Thank you so much for putting that on. It's just been a wonderful way to be introduced to opera. But I want to first start off with a little bit of a science-y kind of thing here. When we speak, and I'm speaking now and something's going on in my throat, but I'm now emoting some kind of emotion that is traveling across the room towards you. What's going on? What's the physics behind that?
Well, so maybe just to start with, what is sound at the very basic level? So sound, right, we are surrounded by air. And if you think about air pressure, right, is this idea of how dense material is at any given point. So if you can squeeze air together, right, like if you're blowing up a balloon, you're pushing really hard and you're pushing air into that balloon. And so there's this area of high pressure that you're creating with your lungs, with your diaphragm, that is going into this balloon, right? When you talk about air pressure on a much finer level, like to the degree of atoms wide, right, areas of high and low pressure in air propagate through space as waves. That is what we call sound waves. All it is just very little pockets of air that are more or less dense at any given point in space. And because pressure likes to equalize, likes to normalize, areas of high pressure move towards areas of low pressure. And so that's how sound is able to travel through space. So when you speak, right, your vocal cords are vibrating and they cause air to be compacted or the opposite of compacted, expanded, and that sound then propagates outwards from your mouth and travels through space to a listener's ear.
And then just to talk briefly about the differences between speaking and singing, actually when I like to explain singing to folks who perhaps are not trained in that musical expression, it's really very similar from a physiological standpoint to speaking, right? Where I like to think about it as three layers. So at the bottom, you have your respiratory system and the muscles and spaces that are responsible for breathing, which is the basis of speaking and singing and everything that we do as humans. But obviously when you inhale, you're inhaling oxygen, when you exhale carbon dioxide into the lungs and out of the lungs. And then there's this large dome-shaped muscle that sits, that separates your thoracic cavity, which is like the upper part of your chest, from your abdomen and your stomach and your liver and your other organs. And that diaphragm, as you inhale, descends, creating room for then the exhalation of air and the production of sound. And so that base layer here, whether you're speaking, you're singing, is the same. And then also one similarity that exists is in that second layer, where your vocal cords, which live in the voice box or in the larynx in your throat, are coming together and opening and coming together and opening and over and over and over again to actually take the exhaled air, the power source, and produce sound waves through the vibration of those vocal cords themselves. And then, of course, the top layer is everything that happens above your throat. And so that's like your lips and your tongue that create consonants, and we call these the articulators, and your mouth that creates vowels, and we call those spaces your resonators. And so that's what takes any vibration of air that's coming through your vocal cords and creates distinct sounds that then our brain can process as discrete noise.
Okay. So then, So then the sound, you know, travels across space and it hits your ear. And the human ear is an incredibly intricate organism that's evolved over many, many, many years, thousands, maybe millennia. And the sound is refracted around the cartilage in your ear and sort of channeled into the cavity in the ear where it hits your eardrum. The eardrum is just a very, very, very thin membrane in the ear. And if you imagine a trampoline, right, the eardrum is like the black part of the trampoline. And obviously trampolines have springs that are all around that black part of the trampoline. There are very, very, very small nerves that then connect to the eardrum that are able to essentially measure the degree to which the eardrum is vibrating and how exactly it's vibrating. Those signals from those tiny nerves are then fed along to the brain, which interprets everything you're hearing as speech, as noise, as singing. And then we understand what we hear.
Well, I'm going to try to articulate this. So kind of what I'm getting is, if I blow up a balloon and I hold that nipple tight and I let the air out, it vibrates, right? So that's creating some kind of sound. But I want to get back to, how are we actually interpreting emotion, whether you're singing or whether you're just talking?
Yeah, so there's a very, very widespread neural network that is activated in the brain anytime we hear sound, and particularly when we hear music, which sort of definitionally, music is just organized sound, right? And so many, many regions of the brain are independently activated and are interconnected. When we talk about feeling, one of those regions is the amygdala and the hippocampus, but the limbic system more generally are activated when we hear music, and that's responsible. Those regions are responsible for things like deep feeling or memory, which is why when you hear a piece of music that perhaps was important to you as a kid, your body feels this sort of visceral sense of nostalgia. But in addition to the limbic system, we also have the reward centers, which is why when you hear music with a lot of percussion or brass, and it's a marching band, for example, perhaps your brain releases dopamine and you feel passion and excitement and thrill. And then, of course, we have other parts of the brain that are responsible for taking that musical input and sort of eliciting a physical response. So when you're sitting in your car listening to the morning radio, for example, you might notice your foot is tapping, or your arm starts moving, or even your hands are shifting around on the wheel. And that's because your cerebellum and your motor cortex are also activated emotionally by music. And then, of course, you have the prefrontal cortex as well, which is the area of the brain that's responsible for analysis and sort of deep, high-level meaning, which is why when you hear a melody, perhaps you start to analyze whether it's ascending or descending and the contour of the melody itself. So to summarize, really, the brain is highly activated when you listen to music, and that's why we can feel so many visceral reactions to it.
So, Lynn, do you think anybody's tapping their foot right now?
I know I started to. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Park City Opera co-founders Benjamin Beckman and Lena Goldstein, and they're helping us understand the science behind voice and singing. And you know, we often think of training vocal cords to become an accomplished singer. But when you were talking about the other physiology, like our lung capacity and our thoracic cavity, you, for example, Lena, did you come into this world with a fantastic thoracic cavity, do you think? Or, you know, because there are people, and this also is another question about genetics, who come into the world and they can just sing. That's my husband. I, on the other hand, cannot sing.
That's true.
And you have not heard me. So I'm just wondering about that.
It's a great question. I'm a big believer that skill can be learned and that no one is born a talented opera singer. And so you'll hear opera singers over and over make the analogy or sort of comparison to athleticism in that sense. But we really highly train the muscles. And when we talk about training the muscles, it's less like the vocal cords themselves and more the way that the power source, the air, as it passes through the vocal cords is then shaped in space and in our upper sort of heads, our jaws, our resonating chambers. But really all of it can be learned. It's never too late to start. When I was little, I was a swimmer, and I accredit that to some breath control and lung capacity. But really, most opera singers come into that career or that training path a little bit later than other instrumentalists because the body itself needs to develop in order for your sound to be fully mature. And so as we talk about the sort of peak of the career or the lifespan of an opera singer, you often see that a little bit more delayed than perhaps many of the other instruments or many athletes otherwise, because your body has to be mature and all of these muscles take many, many, many years to train before your voice is at its richest and fullest point.
So I actually, I have never been an opera singer. I can make no claim to being an opera singer, but I grew up first as a pianist, but I played French horn very seriously for a long time. And I did a lot of professional choral singing throughout my undergrad. The mechanism for breath between brass instruments, wind instruments, and singing is nearly identical, right? I think that there's this very common misconception that when you take a really big, deep breath, you're feeling it in your lungs and your chest is pushing out. But there's actually no motor muscles in your chest. The thing that is happening, as Lena mentioned earlier, is that your diaphragm is descending into your stomach, into your intestinal organs, and creating more space in the chest cavity, in the thoracic cavity. That skill, which is learned, is shared among so many disciplines, not only in music, but even if you talk about breathing well as a swimmer, as a runner, as a skier at altitude here in Park City. And so I think the thing that I find unbelievable about opera singing as someone who does not do it is, as Lena mentioned, we focus a lot of time on finding the exact way to shape sounds, like in your cheeks, in your throat, in the cavity that exists behind your nose that goes down into your throat, in order to create essentially the best resonating space that allows the sound to vibrate most fully in your body before it then leaves your body and is able to project out across the hall. That's what really separates, I think, a great singer from maybe... Well, I think you're a pretty good singer, Lynn, so.
Okay, so one of the things, the first thought I had when I heard that Park City Opera was presenting these Monday night, the series this summer is A, what a wonderful thing, and B, how different is it? I think you had one of your performances on the patio at the library outside, and I immediately thought, I wonder what that does, because opera singers so much rely on their own amplification, but the way that a 2,000 seat, you know, theater shaped in the right way, how it helps with their voice or projected or encapsulated, I guess is the word, envelops it. How is it when you're singing outside like that and the voice is just going out into, you know, space.
So it's pretty different, and we make no claims to being purists. When we perform outdoors, we do use amplification, and a lot of the reason behind that is because of the way that sound propagates through air and then is refracted off of surfaces. So to talk a little bit about what it's like to sing indoors first, when you're on stage at the Eccles, as we are for our production of Romeo and Juliet this weekend, the singers are singing on stage and they sing out into the hall. And the ceiling is a hard surface and so are the walls, right? So sound spreads naturally in a conical shape. right? So if I am speaking, the way that the sound propagates outwards, it's like if you put a snow cone on the tip of the snow cone at my mouth, and the sound propagates outwards that way. So if you're behind me, you're not going to be hearing me very well. But if you're in front of me in sort of a radial diameter, you'll be able to hear okay. Now, the thing is that in an indoor venue, you can still hear me if you're behind me, because you hear the reflection of the sound off of a wall or off of the ceiling or off of the floor. And so one of the ways that opera singers are able to be heard in the back of the hall is because halls are also designed beautifully to refract sound over across walls, across the ceiling, across the back of the hall. Now, when you sing outdoors, you lose that refraction. And so the only sound that you might hear might come from just your source directly. And in an outdoor space where, you know, the audience might be 300-400 feet away on the library patio or in City Park, where we have this Opera Around the World series on Monday nights, you lose the refraction. And so it becomes very hard to hear a singer a cappella, which we, of course, can then solve with amplification.
The other difference is that when we perform outside on patios, for example, in our public performances that are free and casual, we're often performing with the support of a piano and a pianist. Whereas when we perform full-length operas, there are many differences. One, you're not singing a three-minute piece, you're singing a three-hour show. And so there's just a different pacing and skill associated with that. But also you're projecting without any amplification, without any microphone, above an orchestra that, you know, could have 18 players or 40 players or 60 players. And so there are sort of many differences, not just in the sound production and the acoustic landing of that sound, but also mentally and energetically when we involve ourselves in those different pursuits.
Well, I can tell you, Ben, having grown up playing both French horn and bagpipes, it takes a lot more diaphragm for the latter. Just saying. We're bringing up the concept of singing on a patio or in the park versus maybe in a opera hall. And I can tell you that having attended the Park City Library performance, it was much different than the City Park performance, because we were getting refractions or echoing from the hard surfaces behind us.
If you haven't been to one of our performances at the Park City Library, there's this very interesting effect on the library patio where you actually hear the echo of the singing off the hotel walls in the distance and maybe even off the mountains. It can be very disorienting for us on stage. Wow. And it took us we've performed at the library 7 or 8 times now. And in the first 2 or 3, we were like, what's wrong with the sound system? Before we realized that it was just this natural echo that's in that space. It's very cool.
All right. Lincoln, I'm going to get personal with you for just a moment. We've had a little bit of a conversation about this, but you got your undergraduate degree in molecular biology from Yale, if I have that
you do
right. So how does one make the transition from molecular biology to opera singer?
You know, as I was young and thinking about a career path, I always was drawn to this intersection of music and science. In fact, I, in high school, shadowed otolaryngologists, and I've always been fascinated when I have my own vocal cords scoped, and often in those exams when they have a camera and a scope down your throat, they ask you to sing, and you can see the different vibration and shape of the vocal cords as you're making sound. And it's a tool that's often used to assess injury to the vocal cords or overuse or acute injury. But I've always been very fascinated by the intersection of science and music. And Ben and I took a wonderful class in college on the physics of musical instruments. And I think it's been a more natural not transition in careers, but melding of interests
than
progression?
You might anticipate.
Exactly.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I think it's just so fascinating that you go down a very science-oriented path. I mean, molecular biology, holy schmoly, but and now, you know, with you here in the studio as an opera singer, it's a pretty unique transition.
There's something unique to exploring your full potential, I think, as a musician or as a singer that's I don't want to say attached to a ticking time bomb in any way, because there are wonderful singers who don't discover that they have voice until they're much older in life. But I had a sense that I wanted to really try to lean into professional music making and to see how that would impact me as a person. And what that led to is Park City Opera and so much more. And I'm so grateful for those choices.
Mm. Before we talk about Romeo and Juliet, and I really want to have a moment to do that, but I was listening to an interview with Brandi Carlile, the singer. She's a lovely voice, and she was talking about there was a track that they recorded where her voice cracked, and they left it in. And it made me wonder, Lena, if what happens when your voice cracks? Does it ever happen to you? And if I were to ask you to replicate it right now, could you do it on call?
Well, there's a incomplete closure of the vocal cords. So like when you say something, and I can demonstrate, but if you speak like this and your breath is, and your sound is full of breathiness, we call that an excess of air. And that stems from like an incomplete closure of the vocal cords at the onset of the sound production. Whereas as you hear now, I'm speaking in a much more articulated, firm way, where the amount of air and the speed of the air traveling through the vocal cords correlates to a more complete sound. And then when you talk about cracking specifically, you're talking about shifts in registration. And so when we're talking about singing, I could sing really low, or I could sing right here where I speak, or I could sing really, really high, or even octave higher than that. And when we have inconsistent transitions between those registrations, that's when you have things like a crack or a shift in the quality of the voice.
As someone whose voice cracked frequently while singing, you know when you go to the gym and you're doing an arm workout and eventually, as I do every day, right, eventually yeah. you're lifting to maximum capacity and you simply cannot lift the weight anymore, and your arm, you go into muscle fatigue. That can happen in your vocal cords too. That is not a healthy thing to do to your vocal cords. It's something that, as opera singers, we try to avoid a lot. As a mediocre to poor choral singer in my youth, if you have a lot of tension in your larynx as you sing, especially usually in the top of your register, your larynx can undergo muscle fatigue. And then in order to continue to produce that note, your brain basically shifts your cords into a different position that allows you to produce that same note, but just without full closure, without sort of the healthy standard production of your voice. And that flip into a different register causes the crack.
Mm, wow.
So we hope that doesn't happen at Park City Opera too much, but...
Why did you start Park City Opera, and why Park City?
This is my favorite question, but many years ago I was an intern for the Park City Arts Council, and I was doing arts advocacy work on behalf of a number of organizations, and realized that when it comes to opera, Park City was wholly underserved, but even more generally with classical music, that the options were not as abundant as we would have liked to see them. And Ben and Liesl and I have always spoken about creating an organization that where the thesis is to bring opera into people's lives in unique ways, using venues that they frequent, as opposed to always asking people to dress up and come to a formal opera house for an opera production. And so we founded the organization just 2.5 years ago, but we've produced more than 50 performances, and we've got our opera this weekend, which will be the largest expansion of what we've done to date, which involves more than 90 artists and creatives from all around the state, the country, and even the globe.
Wonderful. Well, Romeo and Juliet, Friday at 7, Sunday at 3,
exactly,
at the Park City Eccles Center. Do you have tickets remaining?
Absolutely. We're saying Friday is Bring Five Friends Night, and Sunday is Bring 10 Friends Matinee, and we would love to see you at the performances.
This is wonderful. By the way, thank you so much for bringing opera back into my life. When I was 10 years old, my mom took me to La Boheme, and that just killed it. You know, not necessarily, like maybe Barbara Seville would have been a better choice. You know? But, you know, coming to the Park City Opera in the Park, this opera around the world, has really just been wonderful. By the way, when you talk about generating these sort of emotions, there was a piece on Monday, I can't remember what it was. It was French Night, as I recall. The hairs on my arm stood up, and I got goosebumps from one of the songs. So it was just a great experience. Thank you for enriching my life.
It's our pleasure, and we hope that we share many musical moments with you and our broader community.
Lena Goldstein and Benjamin Beckham of Park City Opera, thank you for bringing this to us, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you again for having us.
Thanks for having us.